Hi, welcome to the River Talk podcast. This is a podcast where we talk about rivers. It's not rocket science. It's just something fun that we do to hopefully entertain you guys out there, maybe some education, and just meet cool people. And today we have a really cool guest, Clay. He's from Quebec, I believe. And so welcome to the show, Clay.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, Zach. I'm not from Quebec, but
sorry.
I'm from Camore. It's some people call it Little Quebec.
Okay.
Lots of people coming out west from the east. So I live in Camore. I grew up in Calgary, and I've been, you know, working on the rivers around here for as long as I could work. Run a small company which I launched last year, right at as COVID came on. I call it Green Tongue Adventures. I'm a full-time paramedic in town where I work, where I live. And I also work with Rescue Canada and Paddle Canada. And cool. Yeah.
And you contacted us with an email to like question some of the things we've been talking about, maybe add some clarifications. So that's why we have you on to talk a little bit about rescue and a little bit about equipment. And Aaron and I love having these discussions because I think there's a lot of gray area with like what equipment people should carry, safety topics, that kind of thing. And I think hopefully we can have a discussion that kind of that leads to us understanding better our rescue training and our rescue equipment. So that's what I'm excited to talk about. But before we do, I want to hear more about your company, and it's called Green Tongue Adventures. Why Green Tongue Adventures?
Yeah, well, Green Tongue is like, that's our safe route down the river, right? That's kind of where that came from. And also there was a feature on our local kayaking. It's a little grade 3 river that has been modified for training and for rafting and stuff. And that feature was at one time called Green Tongue. It's since disappeared. We had a big flood in 2013 that wiped everything off the face of that river. And so they had to rebuild it. The company that I started basically was just as a result of demand over my contracting over the years. So for over 10 years, I've been servicing kind of the guiding industry here, mostly in canoeing, whitewater canoeing, training the guides locally and abroad that come through, and certifying them with Paddle Canada certs and also Swiftwater Rescue. And in that, there's always been demand for first aid. You know, people like the fact that I'm a paramedic, so I can talk about those things in conjunction with the training, and they keep asking for first aid courses too. So I've gone into that realm as well.
What is Paddle Canada?
Paddle Canada, it's kind of like your AWA. They came out of what used to be CRCA, I can't even remember what it's called now.
When you said, you said it's like our AWA, you mean ACA. It's like our American Canoe Association.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So it would be like the Canadian Recreational Canoeing Association, what it was called. And they kind of changed their name to, I guess, be a little bit more easier for folks. You know, we always have these acronyms that these clubs or organizations are running off of. So Paddle Canada is like our nationally accepted body. And provincially, which, you know, our provinces are like your states, basically they each will have their own kind of body as well. Like here in Alberta, we have the Alberta Canoeing Association. Paddle Alberta actually is what it's called now. Ontario.
Do these have any, are these government sponsored or sanctioned anywhere? Or are these just private organizations?
They're like private, non-for-profit organizations that provide the certification for the instructors that work in the paddling industry. And there's others too.
Are you required to get a cert? Like if I wanted to go work up in Calgary, do I have to get a cert from Paddle Alberta or Paddle Canada?
In Alberta, if you want to work in the parks, you do need a certification. And some parks only recognize certain certifications, like the national parks would only recognize Paddle Canada. Alberta itself is pretty loosey-goosey and it's business-friendly, as people would say. You don't really need a certification to just, you know, take people down a river. The companies that would be hiring guides would definitely be looking for some sort of certification, obviously, to mitigate their personal risk, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And sorry, when I started this show, I forgot to mention I'm joined by my friend and co-host Aaron Cagnolo, who just joined in. So I'm still learning how to be a podcast host, and so I forgot to introduce Aaron. So Aaron, welcome to the show too.
Yeah, thanks, Zach. Actually, I forgot that you hadn't introduced me. I was just here hanging out. Yeah, great. Cool.
When you just popped in, I was like, oh yeah, people are wondering who is that guy. And you know, I think I'm excited to talk to Clay about Swiftwater Rescue because Aaron and I talk about this stuff all the time. And to get sort of an outsider perspective to have some of these debates with, I think I'm excited to have Aaron here specifically because of that. It sounds like you're more experienced with canoes. Are you more experienced with canoes or rafts or hard shell? Like, where does your background come from?
Yeah, I'm most definitely, like, the number of days would be like significantly higher if you're to separate between rafts, canoes, and kayaks. As for like inflatable kayaks, it's like very minimal. My wife and I did a little bit of work for a local outfitter who did some inflatable kayaks tours, but I basically paddled an X as I was guiding these people in the inflatable boats. So rafting,
Mostly canoeing. Sorry. Is what you're saying.
Mostly canoeing. Yeah. I did I've done a fair amount of days in raft guiding, mostly paddle, a little bit of oar, on the kicking horse. I did one season on the kicking horse, and kayaking. And the majority of my, guiding and instructional experience comes through, the British military program that comes up here. And, they train at a local base, that simulates kind of like desert warfare. So it's a joint, exercise usually between Canadians and the British. Also sometimes, Commonwealth countries come in, and then, the US sometimes comes and joins them as well. And so, while they're here, they get to experience all these different activities. Like, they do a little bit of mountaineering or maybe some horseback riding. And for about 10 years, I did the whitewater portion of their program.
The whitewater portion of their desert training?
Yeah, so that's separate from that exercise. It's part of their retention program. Yeah. They like to, like, they do it two different ways. Like, if they have, they like to try and keep people interested in staying in the military. If they put time and energy into having people in the military, then they'll, want to keep them. Right. So they have all these programs to try and keep them in, and they do it throughout the world. I also did this program down in Belize, for a couple of winters. And, so they, like, if you're afraid of horses, they'll put you on a horse. If you're afraid of water, then they'll put you in a whitewater program.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds like recreation. I was in the Army. We didn't get to go horseback riding and whitewater rafting as part of our training, right? This sounds like recreation for the military.
Yeah, it was recreation for sure, but there was definitely a structure and a goal for each program. Yeah.
So I don't know exactly, this is going to take us too far on a tangent. I'm curious, like, your perspective on the differences between, like, teaching Swiftwater and being a guide for canoeing versus really whitewater. I feel like whitewater rafting is like the main thing where Zach and I are focused. And what do you see, like, the differences between that, like doing the canoeing versus the rafting? Are there some, like, noticeable differences in the way you approach it, the way you instruct and train?
Absolutely. Definitely some differences, but there's so much commonality, like, that it's all the same. I mean, I've been lucky enough to work with companies like Nahanni Adventures, Nahanni Wilderness Adventures, Nahanni Wild, Canadian Rivers Expeditions, and train those guys, their guides. And so, you know, I'm training people who are both canoe guides and raft guides. On very remote expeditions. So we're basically covering all the same things. what would I say the main difference is? The main difference might be the fact that, you know, outside of a canoe instructor's course, like if I'm doing swiftwater rescue courses, the main difference would obviously be some sort of discussion in group management. And it's, you know, you have either a bunch of people on a raft or you have, you know, limited people in each canoe and more canoes to take care of. Right. So that's for me, the main difference. The concepts are always the same in terms of swimming, in terms of like ropes, in terms of, throw bagging. There's some things that, you know, like we would never throw bag anybody from a canoe. And I know that you guys have discussed that in the past, like you never throw bag anyone from a raft. But there are people that do it, but you would never find somebody throw bagging somebody from a canoe. It just would be disastrous, right?
It doesn't sound like a good idea.
Like a terrible idea. Yeah. So you're saying for risk management, there's not a lot of difference in the risks that you're concerned about if you're doing a canoe trip versus a rafting trip, like a multi-day canoe trip versus multi-rafting trip. It sounds like you're saying, like, in terms of risk management, there's minimal differences. Like Zach and I, with like minimal canoeing experience, we could just hop on there and lead a canoe trip and be pretty good. Besides the like techniques for running the canoe, like, is it that similar?
Yeah. I mean, like, basically if you're running, say you're running a guided group of rafts down, and you have, say, you know, five or six boats, how are you managing that group? And typically you have guides leading each raft, whereas a canoe, you might just have, you know, your one guided canoe, one canoe with guides with, you know, four or five other canoes with clients. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to, you know, be a little bit more diligent with those dynamics. And the other side of it is you obviously have to be a little bit more selective in your route planning, in terms of like what line you're taking. Like a raft, you can kind of bomb through everything, whereas a canoe, you would have to, you know, try and either pick a dry line, or, you know, if it's okay, you can go for the meat, but obviously you're looking at where you can clean up and how you can clean up afterwards. And because people swim a lot more, obviously, in canoes.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was surprised, because from an outsider's perspective, it seems like it's kind of different. Like one of the things we talk a lot about is like when you throw up a raft, how you handle that and what you do and your approach to it.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like, so that, I mean,
canoe is the whole thing, because it's most likely not your canoe. It's somebody else's canoe. And you're like, it seems like we've talked about this expectation of being able to flip your raft back over in 2 minutes, for example. Like, and that's, right. I feel like, you know, in the rafting, that's one of the big things is handling those. And it seems like that seems so different to me, like, and how to mitigate that risk. And you've got like six canoes following you down, and, you know, like how you eddy out, how you approach safety. Cause you know, it's a raft, each raft has got a guide in it. So each raft can watch the raft in front of them. Well, I'm assuming your guests are not pretty. Do you want your guests rescuing the other people, or does that kind of just turn into a nightmare? And you're just like, no, just get out of the way and we'll handle it, type of stuff.
Yeah, for the most part, that's what you want to do. I mean, the question is like, which class are we in? Are we in swiftwater rescue class, or are we in a canoe instructor class?
And that's right? Why, so, I kind of wanted to ask those questions, was because I feel like one of the places where Zach and I have ended up a lot on the swiftwater discussion is you take these swiftwater classes with firefighters in them, and it's a mess. And I feel like it's not an efficient use of my time. Like when I'm in firefighters, and I kind of wondered, that's where I was leading with this, is like, you know, we're lumping them all together to do, it seems like certain parts I can see are very similar, but then it seemed like there'd be other parts where it'd be like, well, it seems from an outside perspective, that would be different. And I would rather do a course with just canoeists or just rafters. I don't know if that's true or not from your perspective.
Well, I think, you know, aside from like flipping a raft and the techniques to maybe flip a gear raft or a loaded raft versus, you know, unpinning a canoe or unpinning a raft, like, you know, a 3-to-1 is a 3-to-1, vectoring is vectoring. It's the same thing. And you want to kind of talk about the same sort of approach, right? Like, you know, you take your time for a pinned boat, you take your time, you figure out which is the best approach, you know, how you're going to secure it and what progression you're going to take. In terms of like flipping a loaded raft versus like how to tow in a canoe, like I would never go so far as to actually, you know, talk about rescuing a loaded canoe on a swift water rescue course. That would be, I would just kind of cut that one off and say, hey, you want to learn that? Go take this course. As for, you know, specific clientele, if, you know, I have a mixed group of like rafters and canoers, we may touch on techniques for flipping a loaded raft, like a gear raft, but we wouldn't necessarily, you know, we wouldn't necessarily touch on flipping an empty raft. We would just do it. We would just cover that one because it's fairly easy. It's quick, right? Like there's not a lot of different techniques involved in that one.
Okay. I want to go back a little bit. Yeah. I want to go back a little bit here. Do you mainly teach guide instruction or rescue?
Well, like for canoeing, that's part of it. I mean, you have to be able to teach that, right? That you can't take people into a canoe in a whitewater environment and not know how to actually clean up the mess. So you'd have to, that is definitely a pass fail point for sure.
Rescue. You're saying you have to teach rescue to canoe guides.
Absolutely. To canoe instructors. If I'm teaching, say, a family group about canoeing, I'll still be talking about that stuff because they need to know, right? Like they want to know how to get down the river with their family safely. So part of that is recovering your gear so you can finish and get to your car. So, it's a huge part of it, I think. Kayaking is a different animal completely, but you still have to be able to like, you know, this is how you bump in a boat or do a T-rescue or like, you know, watch your friends and make sure that they're safe as you're moving down the river. But a canoe is like a huge bathtub that floats down the water and catches, you know, tons of force if it's pinned up against something. So it does definitely take up a lot of time in a course.
Aaron, you have canoeing merit badge, right?
Oh yeah. I got my canoeing merit badge. That's right.
You have some experience. just so you know, Aaron and I both are Boy Eagle Scouts that have a canoeing merit badge. Oh, yeah. And nice. I did some canoe guiding in Texas for a while. And I mean, I think personally there's one big difference is that when you're canoe guiding, you're on like class 2-3 rivers that are like pretty easy and flat. When you're guiding whitewater, you're in a much more chaotic environment. And so when you're doing a rescue canoeing, it's typically like in a pretty straightforward situation. A lot of raft rescues are in more complicated dynamic environments because you're typically on more difficult whitewater. And so I think that's one big difference between canoeing and rafting.
Right. Yeah. I you can't argue that. I mean, if you're pinning a raft, you're likely in something that's 3 or higher, like a 3 plus or higher, right? I mean, that's unless you shouldn't be out there. and canoeing, yeah, you spend a lot of time going through maneuvers or playing around in class 2 or 3 water for sure. So,
but I think in whitewater, a big difference is like when a canoe flips, it's usually flat. People can get to shore. They can get rescued quickly. When a raft flips, a lot of times it's in continuous whitewater or they're going to go for a long swim. And so managing that is a lot different than managing canoes that flip, you know, and in class 3 and 4 rapids, there's like sieves and there's undercuts and there's potential wood. So like, addressing all that, I think, is one big difference between canoes and rafts.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much everything that we have here is continuous. It doesn't stop. It's it's corner after corner, and it's shallow and rocky and cold, and that is why it's super important for every canoe course to have that piece for sure.
So,
I hear what you're saying about the rafting, right? Like you're pushing a lot higher volume, bigger, pushier water, and
higher volume, just more difficult. Like it could be lower volume, it could be, you know, 300 CFS, but really steep.
Right.
So I would just say more difficult than higher volume.
Fair enough.
Well, I want to talk about the idea. I have a bunch of questions. You wrote us an email about like PFDs and stuff, but I want to get to that. But before we do, I want to talk about the idea of experts with you being an expert and like how people get to the place where they can, you know, share knowledge with others, right? I think Aaron and I've been talking a lot about this lately, like what makes somebody an expert, what makes somebody able to give opinions about things. Like, and I think Paddle Canada is maybe one way that that helps, because there's like a certifying agency. But how do you feel about that? Like, what makes somebody an expert, and like what makes you an expert?
Yeah, well, personally, I mean, that I, as I alluded to before we started, it's I suffer from imposter syndrome, and when I, and then you have people, you know, who are a lay person for either medical or first aid or river stuff, and they're like, hey, I want to talk to the expert. What do you like? What's your opinion? And you're like, wow, am I really the expert? Because then, you know, I go on Instagram and I see all these other people doing stuff that, you know, I'm at home taking care of my kids and they're out playing all the time, or pushing their limits. What makes me an expert? I think just if you want to call me an expert, it would have to be the fact that I've spent enough time training and exploring different approaches, talking to different people. And like, if I like, really my approach is always to incorporate knowledge from other people and try to make facilitate classes as a discussion more than just me talking at folks. So I really try to avoid that expert type of approach, and rather like go through some guiding principles. If I was to be compared to somebody who's, you know, just getting into boating or maybe a few years in and you know, has done it primarily recreationally or primarily as a guide and or vice, you know, like hasn't really had a broad spectrum, then maybe I could you know, pounce on that a little bit. Or if I'm talking to somebody who, you know, a lay person about medical things, you know, that might label me as an expert over them, but there's always somebody who knows a little bit more, right? Or always somebody who's had different experiences that can help out, help answer questions or help deal with situations in a more timely or you know, succinct manner. You know what I mean? Like it's so relative. It's really hard for me to label myself as an expert, but rather as somebody who's, I got a lot of ideas and a lot of, I've been through a few different programs and I've worked with a lot of different people. So I got some ideas, but I'm expert at sharing with other people.
Yeah, I like that take a lot, because I have this feeling, I don't know if we can really have experts. Maybe I'm playing devil's advocate here. It's really hard to have people who are like experts or the answer on things. Whitewater, because there's so many disciplines like SUP, kayak, raft, canoe, inner tube, whatever it is. And then there's high volume, low volume. There's continuous rivers. There's people who drop big drops versus people who like big water. There's so many different disciplines, and a lot of them require a different way of looking at things. Or I feel like, you know, you can be a class 5 kayaker running 50 foot waterfalls, but that doesn't mean you can raft guide class 3.
Yeah. You know? So I mean, think that it's something that I've, you know, encountered quite a bit. I mean, you have expats from the UK who are, you know, they come out to work with the British military. I've had this a couple times where they're like, oh yeah, I'm a class 5-6 boater. I'm running all these drops out in the UK. And then they come over to Canada and they're like, okay, so now we're on a class 4 and it's continuous and it's freezing cold and you have no room for like goofing around or messing up. Yeah. You don't want to be swimming at all. And they're making all these calls that we're like, you're pushing the limits here, buddy. Let's not do that. Let's take a step back and maybe, you know, approach it a different way. Another example, you know, had class 5 kayakers, who, you know, they just got off Stikine Canyon. And, you know, at the end of my canoe course, I'm like, I can't give you a full pass, buddy. It's just not working. And it has to do with, you know, the approach to what line you're taking, as much as it does as to, you know, how your paddle paddle strokes are affecting your boat and when, what the timing is of those. And it's a larger vessel and, you know, it's endless, right? The variance, like you say, is relative and there's so much to it.
Well, let's talk about some rescue stuff that you brought up to us. And first, one of the first things you mentioned was, and I'm always trying to learn about this stuff. So I'm looking for like feedback and ideas from you. And just so you know, I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit. I almost always wear a rescue PFD. I don't always wear one, and I don't always wear one when I'm guiding even. But most of my – I have like five PFDs. I think three or four of them are rescue ones. So I'm not against rescue PFDs entirely, but I don't think they're for everybody. I feel like
there's times that make sense, sometimes they don't. Zach, I don't wear a rescue PFD.
Yeah. And Aaron's guided the hardest rivers in the world. Now, right. I think in the Grand Canyon, you may not see a need for a rescue PFD. But there may be some other river where it might provide value, Aaron. Or are you just like, nope, never?
I'm not nope, never. I just like, I can buy, I think a lot of the reason I haven't is historically the life jackets I could buy with the most flotation were rescue PFDs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I valued having that extra flotation over having, I thought that was much more important to my safety than having a rescue PFD. And I still to this day have not worked a trip or seen a trip where a rescue PFD, you know, was needed.
Same with me. Yeah. I mean, there's fair times enough. When like we could have used one maybe to maybe do something, but it wasn't necessary.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. I think with that background, I get the impression from you think they're important. Like, talk about how your feelings about rescue vests.
Well, I mean, I use mine in a different way than you guys do most likely. And I think I remember hearing something about Priscilla clipping into her raft with it to hold her raft or something. I mean, I use mine to pull my boat up and down the side of the river all the time or whatever. And we're talking about a solo canoe or a tandem canoe. If you're looking at like, does every guide need to have a rescue PFD? I mean, and then we're going to be like, well, if you don't have the training, then why would you wear one? Well, why don't you have the training if you're guiding? That's my first question. The second question is like, is it a tool that, you know, it's called a rescue belt or it could be like a tow tether or there's a lot of different names for it. It has a lot of uses and
let's talk about toe tethers separately. Toe tethers are a different thing. Let's talk about the like harnesses around the rescue vest.
Yeah. For me, I see it as like a personal safety piece of equipment. Like I like having it because I know that it's something that I can be clipped into for my own safety. And we can talk a little bit about that more later. As for like having to do a live bait to rescue somebody is... I've never come across that personally, but I have come across the need to wade out and get somebody with a foot entrapment. And it's kind of similar to like a live bait, but the support and the availability of that belt is, I think, pretty important for me personally. And I totally get how Aaron, you've never worn one, and still managed to never need one on a guided trip, but totally understandable because it's not something that, like I say, I mean, when's the last time you've actually had to?
I used to wear one. I still have two vests with them on them. I'm curious, like when you say train with it, what are you? How are you training to use it? Like, what are the ways, like, how do I, like, let's say I'm a new guide. What trainings do I need with it? First of all, like, what do I need to practice? And then I understand you need to practice, like, releasing it. You know, I get that part. Like, okay, I need to practice releasing it in case I get, you know, float downstream, I need to release it. I understand that part of practice and releasing it. But how are you training with it to use it as a tool?
Well, your training, how it feels to be tensioned on it, your training in terms of like how you're threading it and for what application, and also how the tail is like how you've set up the tail. That's what's left mm-hmm. through the belt. There was the original Astral vests. I don't know what they were. I can't forget what they're called. If it was the original green or not, but they used to sit really low, and the mm-hmm. belt would sit kind of below the rib cage, and that is not a good thing. So how you wear it, like on your chest versus your abdomen, you know, what type of material is the belt made? Is it floppy or is it stiff? That kind of stuff will change how well it releases, or if it happens to get bound through the tri-glide, right? That kind of thing. And also, like, there's also, you know, what connection point you have on the back. Is it going to slide from side to side, or is it going to, you know, or is it held in one spot with a friction device? There's so many different things when it comes to the rescue belt that, you know, you should be covering in a course. Now, as for like personal safety.
So the safely using it, I understand to like to make sure it'll release properly. I understand that part, but if I don't wear one, then I don't have to worry about that. I'm more like, why do I want to have one on me in the first place?
Well, if all you're doing is
what training are you going to also train, like how to use it, like as a tool, not the tool stuff, like the release part, but how, like when you're clipped in, what you're going to do with it. Like that's my, I guess that's my big question. Is like, that's the part I'm really curious about is to hear is like, why should I have one on me?
Personally, I find the most useful thing that comes from a rescue belt is a tethered wade, and also, as a raft guide. So for you, it would be as a personal safety item. So in the case of a foot entrapment or like, say if you're stuck on a strainer and you can't get yourself off, if the way you have your tether set up, if you have it under your arm or over your shoulder. So if it's over your shoulder, it's actually way easier to access. Like if someone has to come and access you, they'll have a way easier time accessing that belt, the tether that's sitting over your shoulder, than if it's underneath you, like under your arm.
So we're getting into the cowtail, which I think is almost a separate thing. I think I understand what you're saying. As a guide, you would wear a rescue vest for your personal safety, not necessarily to save other people. As a raft guide.
As a raft guide. Yeah. I mean, as for you guys, the other side of it is the tethered wade. And I think that's super important.
And the tethered wade is, so you walk, like you're on live bait, but you're not swimming. You're just walking out to grab somebody.
You're walking out to grab something, somebody, some trying to get somewhere with it. And it works similar to like if you're, on glacier travel and you're traveling in echelon or single file, you're trying to maintain a certain amount of tension on the line as you're wading out into the current.
So if this is for personal safety, would you suggest that our guests in the rafts all wear them too?
Well, no, because they wouldn't have the training for it.
Got it. So we should get training on it for our personal safety as guides in case we get stuck in something.
That's one huge takeaway that I had years ago, first discovered that this isn't just for like swimming out and grabbing somebody, right? That this was, or towing a kayak in. This was actually something that I could rely on and have. And like, if I get my foot stuck and I want somebody to come and help me, you know, I could grab it and stick it up over my head and like wave it in the air, and maybe someone could come along and grab it.
But that's not the belt. No. That's the cowtail again.
That's the cowtail. But you can't really have the cowtail without the belt. So
yeah.
But in terms of the belt,
before we get to the cowtail, I just want to finish on the belt. You know, like why would we have just the belt?
So yeah, Clayton, you're making a good argument if you have the belt to have the cowtail. But like, I think Zach and I see a lot in the rafting world is like, no one wears a cowtail who's rafting, and then like
people do though, Aaron. Some people do because.
Okay.
I'm seeing it here and there.
I don't see it on the rivers I've worked. I haven't seen people wear cowtails on the rivers I've worked. But But I think so. There's a question about, okay, I've got the harness on me, or I see people with the harness on me. And I think one of the good things that I've taken out that I really agree with you, Clayton, is if you're going to have that vest, you need to have training and you need to practice with it. Cause I've seen so many people who don't lace it through properly and they forget how to lace it and they lace it improperly. And like, just like, there's all these problems with wearing it. And so it's just like, you're not even using it properly. Like, yeah, you look cool with it on, but you don't know how to use it.
Right.
And I think that's one of the reasons I feel like I haven't worn it over the years also, is to be a little bit of a contrarian for all those young people who think they have to have it, even though they don't know how to use it. And yeah, it's just like, it's something that really bothers me. It's like, I think you're going to get yourself into trouble. Like, look, some of these young kids, I'm like, you're going to do something dumb with this because you don't even have it attached right. Your tail's way too long. It's tucked in because you don't like it flying around. And it's just like, what are you going to do with that? Like, but, you know, right. And like, that's one of my concerns. So I really love that you're talking about the training and what you need to do to use it. And I think the next question is, okay, if you do have it without the tether, like I think, cause Zach, I think we'd like to spend a time talking about the tether too. I think that'd be very helpful. But if we have these guides and these people on private boaters who are wearing a rescue vest without a tether, well, how are they using them? I want them to question, like, well, why am I wearing this thing? Why do I have this extra gear on here? What am I going to do with it? Am I prepared to use it properly? Is it making me safer the way I have it right now? And I think, like, I'm curious to come back to your tethered wade. So the tethered wade, what's the advantage of the tethered wade versus me just wading out without a tether? Why would I want to be tethered versus not tethered?
Well, I mean, it basically offers support. I mean, you could wade out in something that's a little bit more pushy with the support of having the line on your back. So obviously you're going to be belayed, right?
And yeah, that's my question, is because my understanding of the way I'm supposed to wade out is I'm supposed to wade out facing upstream. And if I'm wading out facing upstream, how am I tethered?
Well, you're not going to be wading outstream necessarily. You could either do across a river or downstream or kind of.
Aren't like you supposed to have your feet facing upstream when you wade? So you don't
get. So this is this is like.
These questions, Clayton, I don't mean to like anything. Like I can see use to the tethered wade, but I also want people listening to think about this and be like, hey, so, guess what? Your feet are downstream now, so you got to be more careful.
Yeah, so that is part of it, right? It controls your descent. So your foot entrapments happen when people have put their feet down, they're moving downstream, and their feet start sliding in the bottom without control. The ability to walk downstream on a tethered wade will give you that ability. Obviously, you're going to be doing this not just with the tether, but you're going to be using a wading adjunct as well. So like a paddle or a staff or whatever you end up using. And this is done under control. Absolutely. You don't want to be moving downstream with your feet sliding around. So that's one of the biggest things that you're going to be training on with a tethered wade. You can go kind of diagonal, you can go downstream, and that's why it's used. It blew my mind the first time I saw it. I called, a dozen people. I'm like, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And it's been used quite a bit by fisheries up here. And now I don't go a course without teaching it, because it really is a great tool. In conjunction with your wading staff or a paddle or whatever it is that you choose, you can really lean on that rope and the belayer, if they know what they're doing. Obviously this all takes a little bit of training, can support you quite a bit. And the idea is that you're going to maintain a bit of tension on that tether. So that's one of the, I mean, outside of a live bait swim, to get equipment, get a rope out to a pinned raft or get in behind a rock and bring a rope out. I mean, and that in itself is problematic, right? Like, not a lot of people know how much rope it takes, right? Like, it takes it three times the width that you're swimming across at minimum to get to that point, right? And how are you going to swim with a rope pulling on the back of your...
Yeah, all that. All that. I'm going to say this. Zach, had you heard of tethered wades before?
I never heard of it.
Clayton, I never heard of tethered weights, and this is by far the best use I've heard of it. So I'm really happy you come on. And it's just like, okay, like, yeah, like I can see places where you'd want to use this. So you're like, I have to, just the access, I got to go downstream to get to something. There's a lot of current. I'm worried. Well, this is my best option. And I could see using it there. And I think.
Wouldn't a better option though be to have just like four people in like a V formation pointing upstream, walking outside?
And walking backwards down to something?
Yeah. Like is this something like, I feel like if you have five or six people, you do like the weighting we learned the tethered weight might be if there's just like two people, or is this something you think is better than what we learned?
Well, I think it depends. You have to have four people. So you're going to have to involve guests most likely in this case, which is like brings in its whole other can of worms. So I think Zach, I agree with you. I think the V weight, or if I'm walking upstream to it, no, I don't want this. But it's intriguing to me to think about and be like, okay. I mean, I think the next question for me is the thing, Clayton, I'll say is like, I only have like X number of hours I'm spending on training. How important is it to spend my time training to do this versus spending more time using my throw bag, practicing flipping, practicing swimming? And that's the other part that I think about a lot of these cool things. And we got a lot of people who love gear, is it's about fundamentals, you know? And like, and I don't think this is a fundamental skill. I think this is a secondary, more advanced skill, which definitely find a place for. And if you're really good with all that other stuff, but if you're not good at swimming rapids, you're not good at climbing back into your raft, you're not good at throwing a throw bag, I have a hard time saying, yeah, go learn this. Like, dude, you need to train hard on those other things. You got to crawl before you can walk type.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the fundamentals of any swift water rescue course should be swimming, right?
Yeah.
And throw bag.
Yeah.
And the way that people approach throw bagging, I think, is all wrong as well. So,
well, that's good. I need to talk about that too.
Let's get the throw bags. I'm going to move this along. I want to finish up with just one thing on rescue belts so we can move on. And I think that Aaron and I have been thinking about this. Sometimes you have a choice, flotation or rescue vest, right? And if a rescue vest is, I feel like the reason you wear it is personal protection in case you get stuck on something. I'm going to choose actually flotation because I feel like flotation 9 times out of 10 is actually what's going to save me. And I think, you know, if they made the 24 pound rescue vest, that's the ultimate thing. But I think NRS makes one that's like not that comfortable. But I think that's the issue, is that all the rescue vests are minimal flotation. And so I'm going to personally try to choose float. I'm going to choose what looks cool first. Right. And what looks cool first is typically low float rescue vest. So that's probably what I'm going to wear. Aaron's going to choose flotation first because he doesn't care about how he looks, because he cares about personal safety over how he looks.
Well,
right.
I care about breathing. I like breathing.
Aaron wants to breathe when he swims. And so I think Aaron's take is that the reason you don't wear a rescue vest is because you rather have flotation for your personal safety versus something to clip onto for your personal safety.
What about a snorkel?
Snorkel is a great idea. I think about that too, having one of those attached to me. The other thing, Zach, is that you didn't comment about is the higher flotation vest when they have a buckle in the front, I think it makes it a lot harder to climb back in the raft too. And I think that's the other thing for me too, is it's more drag swimming in the river, and it's harder to move around with. So those are my things. But like I said, the tethered wade, I think that's intriguing. And I would think more depending upon the river I'm working on, I could see making that decision depending on what run I was on and what type of scenarios we were commonly seeing.
Because in the Grand Canyon, you're not going to tethered wave. That's just not going to happen. Yeah. Whereas the Middle Fork of the Salmon at low water, an opportunity you might
tether. Yeah, that's a great example. The Middle Fork of Low Water might be a great place to have it. Yeah, actually, that's a perfect river for that. Like,
high flotation doesn't matter as much on the Middle Fork of Low Water. Whereas the Middle Fork at 6 feet, you want flotation, and you're not going to tether weight on the Middle Fork at 6 feet.
Yeah.
So this gets to like what we were talking about earlier. Like, there's so many different types of river. Like, there's so many different disciplines, and like, there's not a one size. In my opinion, there's not a one answer fits everything. It's sort of situationally dependent.
And Clayton mentioned earlier, he talked about this Canadian rivers that are shallow with continual current.
And yeah. that's where I live. That's basically our eastern slope system. I mean, if you go out west, they're cool, drop, and warm. So it's a completely different animal, right? Like, you know, raft guides come out from west, they come out from out east, and they come out here, and then they're like, well, why can't I flip here? Yeah, well, because there's two more rapids, and either your clients are going to be either crying or hurt at the end. Yeah. So let's not do that.
Yeah. Right, let's just quickly talk about cowtails, just to get that behind us, because you keep alluding to it, Clay. What are the cowtails good for? What are they useful for?
For the most use that I've had is pulling my or clipping into my canoe and standing in an eddy as I talk to people or walking up and downstream. The other thing that I've used it a lot for is obviously towing a kayak or towing kayaks that I have to bring in. I've seen a video that came out a few years ago of some people clipping into somebody and pulling a person in. And I think it was a European thing. And discussions I heard on that subject was that it's actually how they train in Europe is to clip into a person. So if you're in a kayak and there's somebody swimming, you clip into that person and pull them in with your kayak. I was like, well, that's crazy.
I've learned that for unconscious swimmers. So if you're a safety kayaker and you have an unconscious swimmer, then you take the cowtail, put it through their PFD loops, clip it to itself, and pull them to shore. I don't think it's in Europe. I don't think they do that for conscious swimmers. I mean, at least Mark didn't.
Yeah.
You know, I talked to Mark about this. They don't. He was saying they don't do that. So I think that's an unconscious swimmer technique for safety kayaking.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. That aspect of it. Outside of that, with the live bait rescues, I mean, in practice that we go through those scenarios and those evolutions. But the one thing now that I consider one of the most important things for me is having that access for somebody to help me if I need it. That's kind of where I stand on that one.
If you're pinned on a log, you have a built-in rope from the ring in the back of your PFD that you could get to them to easily clip on and pull you off. That's the general idea. It's like a extension arm so you can be better stabilized if you're stuck somewhere.
Yes. Yeah.
And that, would you say that requires training before somebody has a tow tether or a cowtail?
Yeah, you still need training on the belt so that you know how it's weaved through, where it sits on your chest, how much tail you should have, yada, yada.
And then in your email to us, I just want to quickly talk about side entry PFDs. It sounds like you prefer side entry PFDs over the head PFDs.
Yeah, and this is something that I just want to know what else people are doing in this regard in terms of equipment entrapment. So with Rescue Canada, it seems to be expanding a little bit, but we practice exiting from your PFD as if you were entrapped by it. And there are quite a few examples where people have died because they've been caught by their PFD. And I've personally experienced, not myself, but I've seen a friend of mine get stuck on the horns of a raft and surfed for a long time. And he was very close to expiring.
How did he get stuck on the horns of a raft?
So he was, we're running a Class 4 set to set up for a movie shoot up here. And he was pushing through a hole and he got spun on the hole and side surfed and bucked out. And as he was falling out, he caught his, the shoulders, the lapel caught on the horn. And because the raft was side surfing, he was on the low side and he was actually getting stuck. Like he was in the foam pile. So he was there for a long time. I was in a kayak about 200 meters below watching. And then there was another guy coming down on a powerboat, which he had to kind of like, that was our only route down. So he had to sit up there and wait. And I was about to pull out of my kayak, start running up. Cause I couldn't really figure out what was going on. I was just seeing it getting surfed and he wasn't getting flushed out and I couldn't see him high siding or anything. So it's like, well, I better go check. And then by the time I pulled my skirt and popped out, the raft came out and he was like just laying there, in the boat. Cause he managed to get back in the boat after and like said he was moments from passing out, in that case. So anyways, that's just one example.
When you say he got caught on the horn of the boat, what's a horn? I don't know what that is.
Oh, sorry. Like the oar right.
Oh, got it. Oh, okay. Got
it. Like the pin or the lock.
Got it. Yeah.
So I can't visualize why it'd be more advantageous to have a side entry than a front entry for this.
Oh, front entry is fine. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, okay. Okay. Not over the head. Okay. Okay.
Not over the head. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. 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 Okay. Yeah. That totally makes sense to me. Yeah. 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 So
in our practice, it's very common that people with astrals cannot complete the drill. Where it's with, we have side entries or front entries, people can get out of their PFDs easily enough. And then it begs the question, like, why would you ever tell somebody that they should take their PFD off? It becomes a big discussion, but it's kind of a muscle memory thing and a tool that's in your toolbox. And so if you know that you can do this, it's a last resort, right? And we've seen, I don't know if you saw that, there's a video of a Russian guy. He got pinned under a log or something, or an old dock or a bridge abutment. I can't remember what it was, but he was stuck by his life jacket. They managed to get him out.
Would you, if you were your friend though, in that situation, would you have taken your life jacket off when you're outside of the raft in the huge hole? I don't know. I'm just curious. Like, I was like, swimming, I don't know what the best option is. Yeah.
Swimming without a PFD is like super dangerous. So just because you have your PFD off doesn't mean you're going to live.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen somebody try to swim across the river without a, I didn't see that. I was there. I wasn't there. I showed up on scene where somebody tried to swim across the river. They swam a class four rapid and never saw their body again. So like, I feel like if you shouldn't, if you swim a class three rapid without a PFD, your chances of dying are high. So
jumping in the current at the bottom of a river, you know?
So I think that in his case, him being unconsciously attached to the raft might've been better than swimming a big volume rapid without a PFD. But we're on debating about like what ifs on a scene. We weren't even there, but flotation is a big deal.
And going back to Clayton's original point, I could see points being where you're stuck on a stick or something like that, and you like, oh, hey, I need to, if I unzip my jacket, I'm not stuck in the strainer anymore or something like that. So I could see that being an option. That would be better.
Yeah, but Aaron, going back to the thing, if you have X hours to train, do you want to spend the X hours training removing your PFD, or do you want to spend it on reflipping a boat?
I wouldn't spend time training on that. I would just like conveniently already wear life jackets with zippers up the front.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nice thing about Aaron's PFD. He doesn't have a rescue vest because he doesn't take his rescue belt off. He just unzips
the rescue vest. The undoing the rescue vest part's going to be a pain too. Think about that.
That's the hardest part.
Yeah, how do you undo that? Yeah, that's a mess.
So Clay, what PFD do you suggest? I mean, I think most people wear the green jacket because it looks cool and it does look cool, right? But it sounds like that's not the best PFD because it's not side entry and it's low float. And it's also the ring in the back doesn't stay in place. It moves around.
Yeah. I like the Hustler personally.
Oh, the new Kokatat Hustler.
Yeah.
It's Aaron. It's sweet. I tried one on like the foam contours to your body. It is the most comfortable PFD of all time.
Really?
It's a side entry then, right?
I believe so.
Okay.
I might be wrong, actually.
I don't think it is. I think it's an over-the-top, actually.
Over the top, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like it has the same problem with getting it off and on, if that's something that's important to you, as the as the yeah. Astral Green Jacket. I don't know if the perfect vest exists.
It doesn't, and I'm very frustrated by it. Like, it's you know, where does the knife go? Where is your cow's tail clip? Does it? And most of them are, have it, so it's in one spot. The Hustler has the option to kind of, they have two different options. There's a Salus that has, you can manipulate where the clips into the cow's tail. And how is the rescue belt? Is it going to be in the middle of your chest? Is it going to be to the side and protected? Yeah. Is it low or is it high? I mean, the perfect vest does not exist, and I'm waiting for it to come around.
How much volume does the Hustler have? It looks like one of those little low floats.
It's the same as an Astral. I have to tell you, it is. I've never paddled with it, but I put one on. It was incredibly comfortable.
It looks really comfortable. It looks, yeah.
The colors are weird. The bright neon yellow is not my style.
You don't want to be seen?
I want to be seen. I want to be seen in a cool, like, burnt orange, not like neon yellow, green, or whatever it is. I want to be seen in like a nice red. But not in like neon colors. Let's move on to throwbacks. We're running out of time here. You mentioned throwbacks a little bit. Like, in your opinion, what's the right throwback? What's the right length? What's the right rope diameter? What are your opinions about? Also, you mentioned people throw them wrong. What do you think about throwbacks?
Well, okay, so yeah, like throwbacks, if you can wear it on your waist for a personal throwback, yeah, you should be wearing it on your waist. You should never be clipping it into your jacket or anything like that. It should be on some sort of quick release mechanism. And a Fastex buckle is not that. Your diameter matters. Obviously super skinny is not good, and really fat makes it super bulky and turns it into a big, huge bag of meat that's hanging off your butt. But like, if I'm moving quickly up and down shore, I don't want something bouncing off my ass while I'm running. I want something that's going to conform to me. I want something that I can wear, on a raft seat or in a canoe seat, or even as I'm kayaking. So a little bit low profile, something 70 feet would be nice, because I can over the head throw that full length, but I mean, that's impractical at a certain diameter. So a mid diameter, something that's a kern mantle and floats and, you know, is the size of a small football.
What's a mid diameter like? Like, would you say 3/8 inch? I guess you guys don't use inches, you use metric. Like 8 millimeter, yeah. 9 millimeter?
Yeah, 8 mil probably.
So you're thinking like 70 foot, 8 millimeters, nice. You also mentioned earlier that, you know, you don't want to clip it onto yourself. I agree, you don't want to clip it onto your PFD. I sometimes on easier rivers clip it in my boat instead of wearing it around my waist. And I heard you say you never do that. Are you okay with that, or do you feel like we should always have a waist?
No, that's not what I mean. Like, I never clip it to anything other than something that it's designed to be attached to.
Okay.
But if I'm cruising down on a raft, sure, I'll have a clip to the frame or something where I know it is. The one thing is that if you're taking a group down and you want to like get out for lunch, or you're going to scout something or whatever, and you've left it behind, then that is obviously a disadvantage. I mean, as a professional, I don't think you should be, you shouldn't be scouting or walking along shore without a throw bag or a walking aid, like a paddle, but that's just my opinion.
I mean, I teach that. I feel like we all agree that when you scout, grab a throw bag. And so the nice thing about a waist belt throw bag is you just have it, right? But for me, so if I'm running harder rivers, I typically do that. On easier rivers, I'll leave it in the boat, but then I'll remember to grab it for the scout. That's what you're suggesting. Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the having a thick line is like 11 mil is, was that a half inch? That's nice for the person that you're throwing it to, and it's nice for you as you're pulling them in. But how far can you throw that? And you're not going to be wearing that on your body. So it's it's give bit of give and take there.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that.
I feel like we're all kind of in the same ballpark on this one. Is like a throwback that you can wear on your waist. You're much more likely to have it on you when you need it. You know, I remember like 20 years ago or so, this guy had one. He's like, yeah, you know what? I just, he's like, I started wearing this. He's like, and I found I actually used it because I had it when I needed to use it. And before, he's like, it was always in my boat, you know? And so I think there's a lot of sense to that. And like you said, like, hey man, I'd rather have it be a little smaller, the rope, and I'm a little harder time grabbing onto it. You get the rope to me, than you not make it to me. And the ropes are really nice diameter that I can hold onto. If you need to, I feel like even those thin lines, you can still hold on to them, and you've got the bag at the end to catch on to, and like, you'll make the best of it. Like, yeah, it is nice to be a little wider, but I think it seems to me throwability outweighs the diameter any day, because the whole point is to throw it to somebody.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And throw it past them. That kind of leads into the comment where I mentioned people don't throw their throw bags right. It's not necessarily that they throw them wrong. It's that what we're taught is like either a static belay or you know, you get down and you know, hold on and let the river swing the person in. And I don't really think that that is a good approach, because that's when it becomes harder to hang on for both people, right? So when your throw bag and your line is in the same direction as the current, that's the hardest time to hang on. And that's when you should be employing either a downstream and inland direction with your angle, or you have someone vectoring. So if you see a throw bag going out, you should be either backing that person up and vectoring the line as soon as possible, you should be there ready to help out with it.
Vectoring, you mean getting another rope on it halfway and helping pull it in?
No, not necessarily. You just need to grab the rope, pull it in, right? Like, and you can work your way down
the rope, like as far as you can, and grab it and pull it in at an angle. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, you can even start right where the person's hanging on and then move down the river and start pulling it in.
That's putting more, you're kind of putting more force on the original belayer initially, right? You're more likely to pull them over.
Well, the idea is to pull into shore, right? So you're basically going to be maintaining the wide angle on the line relative to where the victim is. So if the victim's hanging onto the rope and they swing in, as soon as the angle of the rope kind of matches the current, that's really hard to hang on right there, right?
Yeah.
Someone should be grabbing that line and keeping that angle nice and wide.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So not necessarily right away. It's just like when it gets, that's, yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I think this is maybe a little difference between canoeing and rafting though. Like, I'm thinking this makes sense to me on like class 2 and 3, but when I have 5 swimmers and 2 throw bags, I don't have that extra person to do the vectoring, right? Like if I'm running class 4 and 5 stuff, I'm going to set up where I throw my throw bag from so that I can swing somebody into an eddy. Like I'm going to think about where they go to so that they can hold on the best. Because I feel like the times we've used throw bags for safety like this, I don't have that extra person just to vector somebody down. And instead, where I position myself in the rapid, I'm going specifically to position myself in rapid to where I can provide safety, but also pendulum them into shore.
Yeah, fair enough. But once those people are on your line, if they're on your line, like then you should either be making it easy enough that they can hang on. So obviously, if you move downstream, you might miss that eddy. But if you walk inland, if you have the opportunity, obviously all shorelines are different. Then you can maintain that wide angle across.
Yeah, I think, Clayton, that's one of the things too, is like a lot of the rivers we're on, there's not, you're just trying to find a place to put your 2 feet that's solid.
Yeah.
And fair like enough. When you talk about like a dynamic belay, that's nice too, is where you can walk downstream a little bit so you're not getting yanked. You know, if you're like a beach, more open cobbled area, you can do some of that stuff or pull inland or have the vector pull on the throw bag. Those seem like those are good additions, but I will go back to, and I'll say is like, I think most people just need to spend more time throwing the throw bag. Like all these things are great, but I'd rather have most of the people I've seen, like teaching, I've taught a lot of courses myself, Hey man, I'd rather see you throw that throwback another 20 times than us to work on these other things, because you need to learn to throw that. Yeah. You know, your throwback throws are still like, woo, woo, you know, they're all over the place. Like, let's just practice that until we get that. I feel like it's like the basics of sports. Like, what's the basic thing? It's like, we can teach you these intricate plays, but if you can't pass the ball and catch the ball, then all this other stuff doesn't matter. And these are like, these more intricate plays versus the fundamentals are, can you throw the throwback? Can you swim to the eddy? Can you climb back into your raft? You know, and like, if you've got all that stuff down, great. Yeah, then move on to the stuff. But if you don't, let's not worry about this stuff yet. Just get those fundamentals, you know, ingrained.
Absolutely.
And you guys know, Aaron, you know, I did a ton of throwback practice this fall. Like, I went out there, we were just practicing and practicing and practicing more than I ever have. Because we were trying to really really fine tune our scores for the IRF test. There's an IRF, International Rafting Federation assessment for throwbacks. It's actually hard to pass. Yeah, throw in or rethrow in 2 minutes.
And are you having to coil the rope up and then rethrow the coil? Is that how it's done?
Mm-hmm. You can do it however you want. You can choose whichever coiling technique you want. You just have to deploy your throw bag and then redeploy it however you want to get the second swimmer, who, if I remember right, is 25 seconds behind. So the second swimmer comes fast. So the two minute thing isn't an issue. It's the redeployment time that's an issue.
Yeah.
I learned through that time is that the overhead toss is way better than the underhand toss. Like, I've convinced myself that when I have a throw bag, if it's not a big old like NRS 20-pound throw bag, you know, if it's just like a regular, like you said, football size, my overhead toss is way more accurate and quick than underhand for that first throw.
Oh, Zach, I feel even with the NRS 50 pounder, the overhand is better. And I'm not big and strong like you are. It sounds like Clayton, you like overhand throw too.
The overhand is the way to go for sure. I mean, it depends on who you're.
It's funny as they don't teach, you know, like that's taught like as an afterthought. That's not really encouraged in the swiftwater courses I've taken over the years. And like, it's interesting that we're all come to the same conclusion. Like, I love the overhand throw. I just feel like I can zip it. And we started at, you know, when I was working on the Fule Fule, we had to do this portage. We had to throw a throwback across Zeta Rapid every trip. You had to throw it multiple times. And pretty quick, you know, I was watching the guys that have been down there, and they're all throwing overhand. I'm trying to do it underhand. I start throwing overhand, and I'm starting to hit a lot more consistently, and they're not making fun of me anymore. you know, it was like, it works really well. It's interesting. Like, maybe that's something people come out of listening to this, so go out and give it a try. Try throwing some overhand if they're comfortable throwing overhand. I think that's not true of everyone, but if you're comfortable with an overhand throw of just objects in general, it's worth trying.
Having done a lot of this, I think the overhand throw is better for accuracy to a moving person, because you like leading like a football. The underhand is better for length. If you want to maximize the distance, I can throw the full length of a 75 footer underhand. I can't throw the full length of a 75 foot throwback underhand. But also, like, the floppy NRS bags, you can throw them overhead, but they don't throw well. Like, they throw way better underhand because they have that floppy beginning.
I do a flop on the overhand. I'll do a pinch fling on the overhand with them. I won't throw it like a football. I'll do a fling overhand, flick the wrist, and snap it over.
That doesn't
work. You get it pretty far that way.
Huh. Yeah, I've struggled with that.
I like to hold it like a...
You go throwback style
with the big floppy NRS ones. Yeah. You just grab the mouth of the bag and fling it.
Yeah, you'll do that overhand though.
Yeah, I got tiny hands. I can't really do the football throw with the big bags. But if I can palm it, then I can overhand it and I'm happy. But if I can't, then I have to grab the mouth of the bag and either, you know, overhand it or a river that we work on a lot has a lot of cables over top for erasers, and that becomes pretty problematic with overhands too.
With the overhands,
yeah.
Well, gentlemen, we're over an hour. We probably want to wrap this whole thing up. And before we do, Clay, do you have anything you want to add or talk about before we wrap the show up?
Oh, no, thanks for having me on. It's been a blast. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I know.
I like having the ability to kind of I listen to your podcast walking to work from time to time, and I'm sitting there talking to myself like it's like trying to interject, but no one's listening to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing about this podcast is fun for me, and I know Aaron probably too, is, you know, these are discussions we want to have anyway, right? Like, we're always learning and we want to share ideas and get different thoughts. So we would want to talk to you anyway on a Tuesday afternoon. The fun thing is we can record it, and then other people out there can listen to it, can on their walk, and they can be talking themselves, screaming into their phone, like, "What are you guys thinking?" But I hope that it creates like some education, but also keeps conversations going, so we can all like improve at our safety and our boating skills. That's kind of the goal. So thank you for being part of it, and thanks for reaching out to us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
Well, yeah. We finish every week with gear of the week, and it's some sort of item that you like gear wise that you want to mention. Clay, do you have something for gear of the week?
Yeah, it's a big, huge throw bag last year. It's got a half inch rope, but it's glow in the dark.
Who makes it?
Level six.
So wait, yeah. The glow in the dark, do you have to put it in the sun? If it's in the bag, does it get, like, how long does the glow last? Like, I feel like I've got a lot of questions about this glow in the dark business. Because when you were a kid, the little glow in the dark thing, you'd put it in the light and then you'd go and it'd be light for a little bit.
Yeah, it does have to be charged. It does get charged from sitting in the bag, believe it or not. I found the biggest benefit is actually knowing where my clothesline is at night.
That's what I was thinking. For a clothesline, it'd be amazing.
Yeah.
So you don't run into it and like catch yourself in the throat.
I'm gonna look this up.
Oh, that's great. That is a great piece of gear.
All right. I'm gonna do a quick
for Dyneema.
Wow. I'm looking it up. I'm gonna check it out. My gear of the week is just Arc'teryx in general. I got a couple of Arc'teryx jackets this year, speaking of Canada, and after being a Patagonia guy forever, and their stuff is just better. Like, you just feel the quality. It's amazing. I'm kind of converting over. I'm just super impressed by all the Arc'teryx jackets and everything. So if you have a lot of money and you want to, you know, get one, I'm a fan these days.
Sounds good, Zach.
Yep.
Well, I'll go on. I'm just going to say High Float Life Jackets. I'm a big fan of it. I've got them before, but I'm going to come back and read that. Like, hey, if you're doing some swimming in the river, borrow your friend's High Float and see how it is. I think you're going to find it. Going to be easier. So,
yep.
Yeah.
Well, cool. That's a wrap. Who wants to do the awkward ending?
Well, thank you guys again. Yeah. Maybe I'll be around again for another one of these podcasts someday.
Yeah, we'll see.
Gonna flow me into a new state of mind.